You wanted me back. I'm back.
A podcast by two developmental psychologists, four developmental psychologists, and everyday folk with an interest in infant and child development. I am Candy LaPan.
And I am Dion Benton. And welcome back to the 10th episode and the first episode that we've recorded in quite a long while.
Been a little bit, a hot minute.
It's been a hot minute. I wonder if folks have, you know, I'm sure the thought has crossed people's minds who, like, listen to us.
Yeah.
All three of them. You know, are they coming back at any
they're
point
They're on
in
pins
time?
And needles, like, waiting for all of our thoughtful insights.
This is the longest cliffhanger.
Well, you know, a pandemic year will catch up with you.
Right. Yeah. Pandemics have that effect on every aspect of a person's life.
Hope that we don't have to
podcasting.
Hope that we don't have to learn that lesson again.
Yeah, I know. Speaking of, are you fully vaccinated?
I am, of course.
Nice. What did you get?
I'm Team Pfizer.
Oh my god! No.
Do we have to break up our podcast now?
I think we might. Uh-oh. I think it has to be a bit more adversarial. We may not have to break it up, but I think
I'm gonna make a Zoom background.
Yeah. So I'm Moderna. You know, have you seen those commercials like, hi, my name is Dean and I'm a PC. Or, hi, my name is and I'm a Mac. You know, hi, my name is Dean and I'm Moderna. I got Moderna a while ago, actually.
Mine's been a while
I
now.
I say I got my second dose maybe about a month ago.
Yeah.
So I'm fully vaccinated.
Yes. Well.
I know, like, I had this urge when I was, like, after the 2 weeks or once the 2 weeks hit, I had this urge to, like, go to a mall and ask everyone to do, like, a group hug, like, really to test the efficacy.
I'm not testing it. I am still wearing a mask when I'm in public and trying to only be around other people as much as I need to be, but it's definitely a win for science and feeling a lot better that we are seeing light at the end of the tunnel. So hopefully we get to see you all at conferences sometime soon.
Absolutely. It's sort of interesting though about the mask. So I am also wearing masks or a mask. But I found it to be much more difficult to wear the mask only because I know both sort of consciously and also subconsciously that I'm fully vaccinated. And, you know, so for me, I would, you know, if I'm going to be fully honest, it's much more difficult for me to want to wear the mask only because I know that, hey, I'm vaccinated.
Yeah.
Now, the reason you wear the mask, of course, is you can still be a vector. But also there are other variants now, right? That they are saying are more infectious, not necessarily more harmful, but just more infectious. And so those are some of the reasons why I continue to wear a mask.
Yeah.
That, in addition to the fact that Alina, my daughter, is not vaccinated.
Right? Yep. Mine is basically, to me, I feel like most of the people that are around me that are not wearing masks are also actually probably people that are not vaccinated. So in my mind, I'm just like, put the mask on. I put my own on and yeah. It's a weird world we live in.
Absolutely. And it's sort of interesting. I was thinking about, you know, before we jump into the topic today, I was thinking about the pandemic and the psychology behind the pandemic and how just a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, it would have been weird to go to a mall or to a store and see everyone with masks on.
Oh,
we'd
yeah.
be like, what the hell of is course. Going on? And now the exact opposite is the case. Like, if I dare forget my mask in the car or at home, like, the looks I get, I have to remind myself. So, like, people, like, a couple of days ago, for example, I was in a grocery store, and this guy just kept staring at me. And I didn't consider the fact that, oh, the reason he was staring at me is because I didn't have a mask.
Yeah.
I just thought,
like, what is wrong with this person?
Does this guy have a problem with me?
What does it matter?
Yeah, like, what's your problem? And then it dawned on me that, oh, I forgot my mask, and he was looking at me because I didn't have a mask on. Right? That wouldn't have happened.
No.
You know,
in fact,
that way, I think.
It would have very much been the opposite. I feel like pre this, if I ever saw somebody wearing a mask, I was like, what's going on
Absolutely.
There? Why are you wearing a mask?
What do they have? Right. Exactly. What do they have? Like, you know, let me stay as far away from them as possible.
Yeah, and it was thinking that, like, it was indicative of some disease that they are trying to not spread versus, like, they are trying to protect themselves from other people's germs. So I think it's really flipped the script on how we perceive that. So I actually hope it's normalized because now I think when, like, if you have a cold or something, if you have to be out of the house, like, put a mask on, right? Like, stop, like, spreading your germs all over people.
I will say that... as strange as it has been to wear masks, the one clear benefit for me, at least, is that I haven't gotten sick once. And I'm the type of person who gets the cold at least 4 times a year, maybe more. I haven't gotten a single cold. And so, like, for that reason, I may well continue to wear my mask, you know. And so there are some clear benefits.
Totally on board. I'm not trying to jinx it. So, like, my very scientific way, I'm going to knock on something that's wood and cross my fingers. But yeah, like, I've been very healthy through a lot of this. So thankful for that.
Absolutely. All right. So should we introduce today's topic?
Oh, yes. I think you should go for
it. I made a tweet. I don't know if you saw the tweet.
I did see the tweet.
Yeah, I made it. Tweet from our It's Innate podcast account, and I was sort of like, you know, what do you think today's episode is about? It's going to be about something
that's a mystery.
Super controversial. Yeah.
Super controversial. I think you should, you introduce this set of papers to me, so I think you should introduce today, Dion, our topic. I'm very excited to talk about.
Absolutely. So I will say that today's episode is a bit interesting in that rather than focusing and sort of picking on those who have a more nativist leaning, we're actually going to be targeting our own ilk today, our own kind.
Flip the switch. We're gonna be
exactly, right. I got a comment, actually, from a good friend, I won't call them that, about why do you focus only on, you know, those who have a more nativist leaning? You know, there are issues with papers produced by those researchers who do have more empiricist leanings. And I was like, you're absolutely right, right? And so one of the reasons I decided brought this topic to your attention is for that very fact, for that very reason. You know, I think to be fair, it's important for us to, you know, discuss both those nativist papers, but also those empiricist papers, because, you know, there's issues that we can talk about in both sets of both kinds of research.
Yeah, we're not trying to be biased here, so we're gonna
absolutely
take on our own arguments too.
Right. So so today we're going to be discussing a classic paper in the infant literature that was written by Jenny Safran, Dick Aslin, and Eliza Newport, and that was published in Science in 1996. In the paper. Basically examine the question of how infants go about segmenting speech, right? And so much like, and so I think it's worth, you know, providing some background before we get into the study. So much like other areas of developmental science, researchers and theorists have disagreed considerably on just how infants sort of learn language.
Quite a bit.
So for example, proponents of the sort of nativist position have maintained that infants possess sort of innate mechanisms, right? And so the most notable of these proponents would be Noam Chomsky. Right? And so the crux of his perspective was that because language is, on his view, impoverished, that his children aren't sort of exposed to sufficiently rich data to acquire language. But yet infants learn language, they must possess sort of innate knowledge of the rules of different languages, right? Which are captured by what he calls the universal grammar, right? And so the idea is that as infants, as their linguistic experience increases, they adopt sort of the certain linguistic rules over others, right? That's one perspective. Well, in contrast to this perspective, proponents of the more empiricist position sort of have maintained that in fact, language is richly structured. Right, and that humans possess these mechanisms and processes that exploit this regularity. And so one kind of regularity, and this is where we're gonna get into the paper, that infants and children might exploit when learning language and when segmenting language are the transitional probabilities within and between words, right? And so what does this refer to? What do I mean when I say transitional probabilities, or what is meant rather by that term? Well, this refers to the probability of that some syllables follow other syllables with a certain probability, right? And so consider the phrase pretty baby. This is a common example that's used in the papers we discussed today. So here, the probability that T follows pre is much higher than the probability that bay follows T in sort of natural language, right? And so one way infants might segment speech, that is one way they might achieve this or might sort of solve this problem of segmenting continuous speech is by tracking transitional probabilities. And I should actually quickly mention that, unlike written language, where we can use actual white space, right, to, denote where one word ends and where one word begins, that's not how speech is. If you look at speech or if you listen to speech, it sounds like one continuous set of sounds, right? But yet, babies have to learn how to learn, they have to learn language, right? And so one means by which they can segment this continuous speech is by tracking these transitional probabilities. This would be a mechanism. So the idea is that, they might segment speech via a statistical learning mechanism that tracks these transitional probabilities both within and between words, and that extracts and thus treats as a word those syllable combinations with high transitional probabilities, right? That's the idea. And so the study we'll be talking about today, and really the first study on this topic in infants, sort of examined whether infants can use transitional probabilities to segment artificial speech. Again, the study was carried out by Jenny Safran, Dick Aslin, and Eliza Newport. That's the study we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, I think it's, to give background of like the theoretical perspectives on the paper, that the way that they discuss these is talking about experience-independent or experience-dependent mechanisms and framing it in that way that, if we think of like more of a nativist perspective, they're often proposing that we have experience-independent mechanisms, right? That these mechanisms that facilitate maybe some type of learning well, I'll get into what I sort of think about what that really means as well, too, when I have some comments there. But that it's not dependent on experience versus what they are talking about are mechanisms for learning that require environmental input, and to say that might help us learn.
Sometimes we say in the literature, terms we also use synonymously with those two terms would be like domain-specific and domain-general mechanisms, right? This study was all about exploring whether one kind of domain-general mechanism could support, segmenting speech. Now, we'll talk about the extent to which this study provides support that the mechanism in question is, in fact, domain-general. But that was at least one of the motivations behind this well-known study that's been cited now well over like 5,000 times.
I'm sure quite a bit.
Or 55,000 times or something like this. It's been cited quite a lot, which is a testament to its impact and to its importance. One of the first papers I read as sort of introduction to developmental psychology was this paper.
It's a very clever study, I will say, to start off with. Before we even talk about the details, I will just say, gets me thinking about, like, the ways in which we can try to test some of these hypotheses or predictions about not only what infants know or are capable of, but of mechanism. I think that this is a very, I just think it's a really great novel way that they came up with to be able to do this and to try and answer some of these questions that, infant literature has to be creative at its core. Having to find ways around that, minor limitation. So it definitely makes you think about some new and creative ways that we can start to do that.
Well, speaking of the creative ways, let's just jump into the study.
Absolutely.
So I will mention that the study tested 8-month-olds. The way the study worked is that the babies were familiarized to 2 minutes of a speech stream that was continuous. And this meant that there were no cues to word boundaries, such as those post-utterance pauses that we make when we speak, or sort of stress cues. And the only cue to word boundary in this particular study were the transitional probabilities, the probability with which certain syllables follow other syllables. That was the idea.
Because if we were looking at pauses in speech, which even though we don't really have after every word in actual speech, it's still some type of cue for us. So this was a nice machine reading off syllables that were all... I was looking for... First of all, let me just point out that I'm being really old and I actually printed off my articles on actual paper the other night because...
Yeah, what kind of sort of troglodyte?
I mean, it's honestly, it's like...
exercises that...
It's like pandemic world. I'm just so sick of staring at a computer. I was like, I'm just going to print these off and read on my couch like a normal person and not be on a screen.
And here I am, like, reading the article from my phone. Like,
I was like...
They can't see, but, just, like, the phone is, like, super close to my eyes.
My actual printed-off hard copy. I was looking for it. They have an example of what this looks like. Do you want me to give the listeners a really fun pretend insight
give me one second.
Into what it sounds
There was
like.
A couple of more things I
Go
wanted
for
to say.
It.
So the speech stream itself consisted of 4 3-syllable nonsense words. Each of which were sort of presented equally often, equally frequently. And the words in the speech stream were presented or repeated in random order. And it was the case that the transitional probabilities within words, so these were 3-syllable words, and so the probability that the first syllable followed, that the second syllable would follow the first syllable was 100% within words. But between words, the probability that the first syllable of another word would follow the last syllable of another of a preceding word was just 33%, right? But before I hand the mic off to you, I want to make the reason I emphasize nonsense is because, and this goes to your point about how clever this study is, and I agree this study is extremely clever. So the reason why you might a question someone might have is, well, why would you use nonsense words, right? Language, we don't speak nonsense words, right? What's the point of using nonsense
words? All words are nonsense words when you hear them the first time.
To some extent, exactly. Right, to some extent.
Yeah.
I guess a better way of saying this would be artificial sort of words with which they have no experience. Well, the reason why that's important is because if you're ultimately trying to get at the question of mechanism, you want to tease apart experience from the operation of the mechanism. And so if this first study used natural language, with which infants are have sort of exposure, it would be hard to know whether or not any learning that happens is a function of experience with that particular language, as opposed to the operation of this hypothesized mechanism. And so this is actually a technique that's used quite frequently in studies that look at mechanism, whether it be studies that look at mechanisms for language learning or studies that look at mechanisms for other kinds of domains, right? You tend to want to focus on artificial stimuli so that you can actually sort of home in on the hypothesized mechanism. And so that's what I wanted to quickly say, but I'll hand the mic to you.
Oh, no, again, I just like, I think we're in podcast land, so sometimes it's hard to like visualize what this is like. So I was going to read you some of the ridiculousness.
You got to read it just like they say it too.
So, you know, for example, if we had some of these like nonsense words are Pabiku, Tibudu, right? I'm not going to go on more. But they would all be strung together.
Pabiku, Tibudo, Golatu, Dorapi.
Okay, you did a much better job. I was like about to read it. All strung together in a monotone, no pauses. You know, so it's in reality, it's really sort of like one giant big word that goes on for 2 minutes with no pauses. But the idea that if infants are able to use these transitional probabilities, they are in some way, as the authors describe, probably unconsciously tracking the probabilities of which syllables follow prior syllables.
So like a word like pa-bi-ku, which is one of the words, the idea here is that the probability that B follows pa would be 100%, just like the probability that ku follows B would be 100%. However, for the two words, pabiku and golatu, the probability that go would follow ku, which is one of the syllables from another word, was just 33% across the corpus of language or of this speech stream.
Yeah, that's a very solid example. Thank you, Dion. And
yes.
And I think that it's, again, it gets a little bit confusing sometimes when you're reading or when we're talking about it. So when we say, like, the probability of a word following another word, but again, knowing that when they're hearing the stream of language, It's all together.
Probability of a syllable.
Yeah, probability of a syllable. Yeah. Like, these are all together. So these babies are having to then extract what would be considered a word based on just the transitional probabilities, because there are no pauses and the words are not segmented in any other way.
And the language is artificial, so they can't use knowledge.
There's no intonation. There's no prior knowledge. Nothing.
Nothing. Right. So if they do possess mechanisms that allow them to segment this speech, well, then the what they would likely be doing here, as Candy pointed out, would be tracking the transitional probabilities, because that was the only thing that was manipulated.
Right. And their outcome measure then in this case is that after they listen to this string of syllables for 2 minutes, then they are presented with, it's a little bit...
So they were presented with, well, so there's two studies actually. So in the first, the basic idea was exactly as we laid out. So they were exposed at the very beginning to 2 minutes of continuous speech. Following familiarization, they were given, entered into the test phase. And during the test phase, what they heard were either a word, so pabiku, something they would have heard during familiarization, or a non-word. That was an experiment.
Right, yeah.
Which is which comprised the same syllables from the speech stream, but they were organized in a way that the babies wouldn't have heard. So the word would be unfamiliar. In experiment two, the idea was more or less the same, except that they heard at test a word, so pabiku, and a part word, which is a word that spanned the boundary between two words. So if we have pabiku and golatu, the part word would be dogola, right? It sort of spans the
It was something that they actually heard together at some point, although the transitional probability was not there. Like, they had heard those.
It was lower.
Yeah.
It was lower.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so what did they find? Well, in experiment one, what they found was that the babies listened much longer to the non-word. Now, I should mention here that during test, these words were repeated over and over again. So the word was repeated over and over again, and the non-word was repeated over and over again. And what they were asking is whether or not they prefer to listen longer to the word or to the non-word. In either case, that would indicate that they've detected some transitional probability.
Right.
But in this particular study, they showed a novelty preference. That is, they listened longer to the non-word than the word, right? But the problem, and this is where experiment two came in, the problem is that, you know, the non-word
was
it's true
actually
that the non-word,
novel.
Well, it's true that the non-word differed from the word in that the transitional probability was lower because the baby never heard the damn word. But another issue is that because the baby never heard the word, the performance could have been a function of just being familiar with that
right.
word as opposed to the non-word, right? And so experiment two did a better job of controlling for this possibility, as Candy noted. And so the procedure up till the test was identical. But at test, again, they heard words and part words. So here, they did in fact hear that part word, right? And so the only difference between the two, the word and the part word here in this context, would be transitional probabilities. And so any differential listening to these two different words has to be a function of the transitional probability and not familiarity with the particular nonsense.
Although
that's the idea.
Although for this first paper, and in my first read of it, and probably in part because, again, these are, like a lot of older papers and papers published in Science and Nature, are very short and don't have like tons of detail. I assumed as well that in the second study that they ran, then that even the part words came up with the same
frequency
which
so
they
that,
didn't.
That isn't. That's yeah.
yeah.
So it turns so right. We should spell this out a little
yeah.
bit. So this is an important issue. But just quickly.
Yeah.
So again, the finding is that in both studies, the babies listened longer to the non-word in study experiment one and the part word in experiment two. Well, the problem is that because all four words, so they heard what was it? Pabiku, tibu do, golatu, and dorapu, or daropi, or something, whatever it is. Those words occurred equally often. Well, it turns out that when you do the math, the words occur three times as frequently as the part words. And so while it's true that the words and part words differed in the transition probability, they also differed in their frequency. So the babies just heard the words more often. And so maybe it was on this basis that they discriminated the two test groups, right?
Which,
and it wasn't the case, as you noted, that this was controlled in either of the studies. This was an issue in both experiments. I keep saying studies. This is an issue in both experiments.
I will also say, like, as a non-infant researcher, I always go back to saying, like, even that in and of itself, to me, I would find to be really cool. Like, I mean, it doesn't answer the mechanism question, but I do think that, like, regardless, I do think it speaks to, like, impressive abilities that infants had. Even if that was the case, it's hard for me to see myself listening to a string of 2 minutes of nonsense syllables put together. And I'd be like, yeah, I think I heard that one more than the other one. So it still, to me, even beside the point, still impressive.
What's really interesting on that point is that they actually did a study with adults. So this study was a second study with infants. So they did an earlier study. It was like Safran, Newport, and Aslan, 96 or 97. In that study, they tested undergrads.
Oh, how did they do?
And the same.
Really?
So the undergrads were able to track those transitional
probabilities. I'm so impressed.
So the natural question, and I think one of the motivations for this study was, well, the natural question was, well, can babies, how early is this ability there? You know, when does it emerge? And so that was one of, I think, the motivations behind this particular study. But yeah, you're right. So one of the issues with this particular study, and this is a well-known issue, so I'm not like sort of saying something, we're not saying something that people haven't already discussed, is that, you know, the words just occurred, again, three times as frequently as the part words. And so in addition to manipulating at test those transitional probabilities, the extent to which a particular test item presents the same transitional probabilities as what they heard during familiarization, the two test events again differed in their frequency. And so it's impossible to know on the basis of this study whether or not in fact they're using a statistical learning mechanism, right? Because you have this confound that wasn't controlled for at all in this particular
not
study.
In the first one, no, but that they
not in this particular
they
study.
But that they come back in 98 to address.
Right, exactly. another issue, you know, maybe before we turn to that particular study, which is pretty much identical to this study, with the exception of the fact that they controlled for that issue.
This would all be one paper.
Exactly. Neither of those studies were developmental studies.
No, they only looked at
8 months. They only tested 8 months.
Correct.
Right. And so we can't know based on the study alone, whether there's development in this statistical learning mechanism. We just cannot know. Now, in their defense, I will say this wasn't a principal goal of the study, right? They simply wanted to see whether infants can track transitional probabilities. And so it made sense to test an age that you'd be able to make the case that they can do it.
Right.
Right. So Peter Jusik, who's a big wig in the field, or he unfortunately died much too early, you know, he was known for, and this is something that was communicated to me when I was an undergrad, that when you design a study that looks at a new topic, you want to design a study that works, right? You don't want to try to, you know, do something that's complicated that potentially could fail. And so that could have explained why they tested 8 months, right?
Right.
A priori reason to believe that 8-month-olds would be able to do it.
Yeah,
and I wanted to show that they can do it.
And I was wondering too, again, because I don't do as much, I don't do work with infants, and I don't know the literature as well. So their actual way in which they measured, like we say, they listened more to these part words or novel words. The way that they did this was a little bit maybe different than what I was used to, where they're having, like, it's like an orienting type of thing with a light that's flashing, and they're measuring listening based on how much they look in the direction of that light. And while they do, the sound is playing, the word is playing over and over again. Is that a common type of method that you see, or is that a little bit
different?
For
language studies, yeah. So the procedure they use here was, there's an actual technical term for it. It's called a head turn preference procedure. And the way this typically works is that a baby is, I'll just quickly lay it out so that if anybody's listening and they're unfamiliar, it's worth sort of spelling this out in some detail. So the way this works is that a baby's brought into a lab, and they're brought into a test booth, a sound booth. And in that booth, directly in front of the baby, so the baby's sitting on the parent's lap or the caregiver's lap, And directly in front of the baby is a monitor or something that can draw their attention to the center of the stage. And so what happens at the very beginning of the study is that the experimenter plays essentially what is an attention getter to basically cause the infant to orient directly in front of it. At that point in time, there are two speakers on either side of the baby. So a speaker to the right of the baby and a speaker to the left of the baby, out of which sound can be played. And so once the baby has oriented directly in front of it, some experimenter can press a button to initiate a sound from either the right speaker or the left speaker. And so during the study, the babies would orient to the middle of the screen, directly in front of them. At that point in time, the experimenter would be like, okay, the baby's now paying attention. Let's start the study. Let's start the speech stream. And at that point in time, they would press a button and then the continuous speech would either come from the left or from the right. And at that point, the baby would orient. And as the baby orients and continues to look at that speaker, there's usually a little light either above or beside it that's blinking. It's not sort of tethered to the sound, but it's there to keep the baby orienting. And the idea is the baby will continue to look for as long as they are interested in that particular sound. And when the baby looks away, then the experimenter initiates that attention getter again to reorient them, and then the same thing happens. And so maybe on the next trial, the sound is going to come from the left speaker or the right speaker, right? And the idea is that they use as a measure of preference the length of time they spend looking at either of these two speakers. And so we can infer on the basis of this that if, for example, they're tracking transitional probability and at test, out of one speaker, we continuously play words, and out of another speaker, we continuously play part words. Well, if they have a preference, you would expect them to look longer out of the speaker that plays the word or the part word than the one that plays the word, for example. And that was the sort of operationalization or operational definition of preference here. And that's how these studies typically work. And it's, again, to answer your question directly, this method is mostly used. I've never seen this method used for visual stimuli. It's mostly
sure.
for auditory.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that type of methodology, it probably also drives the selection of an age group. So like what age group would infants be like physically and, you know, cognitively capable of being able to.
Would a newborn be able to.
Yeah. No.
Turn their head? Right.
So we have.
Although Alina could. Yeah. My daughter was able to turn her head when she was like just born, which I was like super impressed by.
She was ready to participate in some studies.
Her head was also kind of tiny too, so it's not like she had a lot of weight. Like, it's not like her head was heavy. Maybe that had something to do with it. Maybe she would have been able to do it if her head was a bit bigger.
Well, I think she's probably ready for some science.
Oh, she's definitely ready. She's about to be 5 months. Anyway, that's beside the point. But yeah, so that's, you're exactly right. So another reason why they probably chose 8-month-olds is because, I mean, can a newborn, can they engage in the action that would be necessary to be able to make any inference about what they can or cannot do
right.
in a study that
And we can't use, like, looking time for something in this case. Or, I mean, I guess maybe you could. That's, like,
you could, but... You could, but that, in order to measure looking time, they have to orient.
Right, they still have to.
And maybe they don't have the requisite ability to orient.
Right, yeah.
Right, and so, yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, that's the sort of stuff.
So that was...
The setup.
Go ahead.
I was just saying. So that's the setup of what we're looking at in this study.
Yes. Again, that one of the issues. Another issue is that, the study I think quite clearly indicates that 8-month-olds can track transitional probabilities, or at least it suggests that babies can do this in an artificial language composed of made-up words. But it's sort of unclear to what extent this ability sort of can support speech segmentation in natural language, right? Language that babies are actually exposed to, in which the transitional probabilities aren't so neat,
right?
Right, and in which multiple cues of segmentation all compete, right? Such as, you know, prosodic cues, stress pattern in language, like all these cues in natural language compete with each other. And so, you know, this study doesn't address that particular question. Okay, it shows that they can do this in an artificial language where you have really tight control over what the baby hears, but, you know, we can't know based on this particular study whether or not this kind of ability would scale up to natural language, to the complexity of natural language. Now, it turns out that there is follow-up work, or there was follow-up work, there has been follow-up work.
Because 1996 was not, like, 10 years ago, like it feels like sometimes.
Exactly, right. Just think about this before I make this point. So, like, you know, to a baby who's, like, someone who's born in, like, the 90s, they'll see us like we see someone who's born in the 60s
or
something.
Don't stop. I don't.
Like, we are, I know. Like, oh, you were born in the 90s? You're so old.
I know.
And that's what I would say.
Teaching college students makes you feel very aware of how old you are.
Absolutely. Like, I ask them questions periodically. Like, I'll say, are you guys familiar with X? And they'll be like, no. And I'm like, and I'm thinking in my head, who wouldn't be familiar with this?
It's because we're getting old. You know, my favorite is when we talk about research and they like write papers and they're like, well, this study from 1996 is so old. They're like, we need new research on this topic. And I'm like, wait, what? Yeah, no, it is actually very old.
No, it is kind of old. But anyway, yeah, some follow-up work by Pellucci, Hay, and Safran in 2009 showed that eight-month-olds can actually track transitional probabilities in an unfamiliar but natural language.
I was going to say, so, that's sort of the next logical step, right, is like introducing them to another language that's a real language.
Yeah, so they were, in this study, they were English-speaking babies, and they were exposed to Italian, and the assumption is that they didn't hear Italian, so it was still unfamiliar, but it was a natural language, so it had all the complexities. But even in that study, they showed evidence of tracking these transitional probabilities. So again, although we can't conclude based on this particular study, the one we've discussed, you know, whether or not this ability, this mechanism can scale up, there is now work showing pretty categorically that babies can do this for natural languages.
But regardless, I will point out one thing to say too, that even with the limitations of the studies of these studies, what I find to be, I don't know, I guess like you can say this is my bias or whatever, but that I like in the end of them is that I feel like their conclusions are still very measured, like that they recognize these limitations. And when they're making assumptions about what this is, they say like, you know, that this is at least evidence that these mechanisms might exist. But it's still unclear, like, how much of this might be due to different types of mechanisms. It's not...
Right.
To me, that's a really stark contrast to some of the work that we've read before that is like, this means that this is definitely innate based on this study that we did. And I think that that is often... It's not typically that I argue the work itself necessarily, but the conclusions that you draw from the work.
Absolutely.
And so here, I find this to be... yeah, just a more measured conclusion that they take away from this.
Well, I mean, the conclusions were measured. Yeah. But there, I think, you know, another issue I have with this particular study is that while you're right, that they're not making sort of these extraordinary claims that would therefore necessitate extraordinary evidence, they nonetheless conclude that this is evidence that the mechanism in question is domain general. That's problematic. The reason it's problematic is because this study only tested, infant's ability to track these transitional probabilities in the auditory domain. And so we can't know, based on this study, whether or not this mechanism is domain general. Now, it's true, we now know with, you know, pretty reasonable confidence that this is, in fact, a domain general mechanism because they can use it to learn tone sequences, they can use it to learn visual sequences. But, you know, I think the conclusion in that particular study that this is a domain general mechanism, I think, was a bit premature because the study didn't itself examine, you know, the operation of this mechanism in other domains other than audition.
I feel like...
Right? So that would be...
I don't know. I feel like... So I'm gonna quote because this was what I underlined as my joyful conclusion, was that they said that our results raise the intriguing possibility that infants possess experience-dependent mechanisms that may be powerful enough to support not only word segmentation, but also the acquisition of other aspects of language.
Sure, they're hedging a bit, but still, they're still making a claim that I think that hedge isn't warranted. I think even that hedge is not warranted because, again, the study doesn't test the operation of this mechanism in a different domain.
But they only say that it's specific to language too. So they said that it was specifically for language. They weren't really making a more general claim beyond that.
Well, when you say experience dependent mechanism, that implies, you know, if the analogy works out just right, that experience dependent is just a synonym for domain general, that implies that they're assuming that this could be a domain general mechanism, but there's no way to know,
sure,
to even make that hedge or that speculation in this kind of study. And so I agree that they do make measured conclusions, but I think this is one of those conclusions that I think I had a problem with, you know. But maybe I'm being, you might be right, maybe I'm being too harsh.
No, I mean, I think it's like more, maybe it's just more of a tonal, like, difference between the types of papers that we've read. You know, I think that, I feel like they still continue to make their claims very specific to the saying, I don't think that it's the same to say that something is an experience-dependent mechanism and saying that that's also domain general. I don't think that's...
Absolutely. Well, that's why I was saying if the correspondence works out just right, that would be problematic.
I think that they're talking really specifically about language acquisition in this case and like segmentation of speech, and that in that case, it seems like, you know, based on their studies, it's like at least a good assumption that this might be at play. And they still go on to then and otherwise explain that, like, all of these other possibilities of innate or experience independent mechanisms are also very likely. And I think in many of the other papers we've read, that's just like, it's just such a stark contrast. So again,
no, absolutely. And even in their defense, you know, they could easily come back and say, well, how would this not show evidence of experience dependent mechanism? I mean, of an experience dependent mechanism. And that's because what they heard was a completely nonsense made up language. There is no other basis. So we can argue about whether or not they're tracking transitional probabilities, but the actual behavior cannot be a function of experience or sort of some, you know, some innate knowledge or whatever, because this you know, the language they heard was completely made up. Right. And so they can easily come back with that argument. And I think that's a valid argument. That's right. Right. And that's actually one of the reasons why this study is so clever, is that it made use of artificial stimuli with which they have no experience, presumably.
Yeah, I think the other thing it brought up for me when I was reading, and again, this was like a novel like description that they use here that I had never, I haven't heard other researchers use experience independent or experience dependent mechanisms. But then as I was reading through my criticism, and I don't know if it's necessarily a criticism of this paper or of the field and what we're talking about, but it brings me back again to these ideas of innateness that we keep coming back to, and what does that really mean? And
does it have meaning?
Right, does it have any meaning? And then what I started to think about was, like, I feel like oftentimes when we are taking an empiricist approach, we're talking about, like, you know, experience being important. We're talking about, we're talking about actual mechanism, whereas when we talk about nativism, and maybe it's linked to the idea of like taking a core knowledge approach, it's often more about innate knowledge than it is about an innate mechanism, right? It's not, we're often saying like infants must innately have this information or knowledge about something, whereas here what they're talking about is something that is, they're actually describing something that is possibly innate. The mechanism itself is innate, and it requires environmental input.
Well, in their defense, and to play a bit of devil's advocate, I guess it depends on the theorist you're talking
about. Of course.
So if you're talking about Spelke, for example, she's argued that babies have these core knowledge mechanisms or systems. And so these systems are triggered by certain kinds of input. So one kind of mechanism she argues that babies have is a mechanism for learning about agency. Well, those mechanisms are triggered by certain kinds of input. So one kind of input that triggers those mechanisms, or that mechanism, would be a self-propelled motion. So if the baby is in the presence of something that's engaging in self-propelled motion, that's going to lead to the inference that the thing in question is an agent, right? Because it triggers this mechanism. Now, on the other hand, I agree that there are other nativists who really do, I think, subscribe to a more principle view. Like they're born with rules or principles. So Rochelle Gelman, she's famous for her innate skeletal principles. So babies are born with these principles or rules for how these domains work. So agents tend to be self-propelled. There's no triggering, as far as I can tell, of a mechanism, right? And so I think we should be a little bit careful, as, you know, we demand them to be, about, you know, it depends on which nativist you're talking about. But you're right, though, that I would argue that it is more often the case that in empiricist accounts, the mechanism is clear, and it's clear that we're talking about mechanism, where it's not so clear for those who subscribe to this other perspective. that we often pick on.
Yeah.
Perhaps unfairly or not.
Yeah, I just think it's just interesting to think about the idea of, like, I'm in the headspace of, not to, again, pick on anybody, I'm in the headspace of like, the moral work, because we've been talking about that and writing about that, where it's like, you know, if I have an innate preference for, you know, helpers, for example, that's like implies some sort of knowledge that you already have, like that you have some knowledge about like who is a helper, and you have some knowledge about like that you prefer that it's different than a mechanism, right? Like there is no real mechanism there. It's just like some inherent knowledge or preference.
When you put it that way, yes. But as you and I both know, you know, Kylie did write a 2013 piece where she argues, or she uses the term at least, innate moral core, which is a mechanism. Now, you know, one criticism of that paper is that it's not clear what kinds of input would trigger these inferences. You know, an inference that this thing is a helper or whatnot. But yet, when you put it that way, though, you know, yeah, it's not clear what the mechanism is. Because what we're talking about really would be the output of some mechanism, but we're not talking about the mechanism or the process by which that output or that inference or that preference might emerge. And that is less of an issue, as you know, and this may be my bias, but that's less of an issue for, you know, those studies that are purporting to show or that have more empiricist leanings. Well, before I get into my main, there's a criticism of the study that I think is worth talking about. And I think it's a pretty fundamental criticism. But before we do that, do you have any?
This was one of the big things, like I said, that jumped out to me. I almost linked it to thinking about, like, are we arguing for basically, like, almost like the difference between crystallized and fluid intelligence? Whereas I see, like, a mechanism is, like, you know, we might have some type of inherent skills, like these tracking statistical probabilities or tracking associations, which then might lead us to be good or successful at some task, versus I don't think that I feel convinced of an argument that, like, we have some inherent knowledge, like crystallized knowledge about the world. It's a very different type of claim. And again, not saying that every nativist is making some type of judgment that is the case, but I think oftentimes that's how it comes across. And that's what I think is problematic. If we talk about innate sort of skills that then are able to act on environmental information, but I think in a lot of the papers we've read, it comes across more as like, babies know how to do math. Like, yeah, what?
Yeah. And this may or may not be a function of evolution.
Right. Yeah.
Right. I agree. Absolutely. I agree. So anyway,
I want to hear about your big criticism.
Yeah. So one issue with this paper, which is a fundamental issue, is it doesn't actually provide knockdown evidence that infants use a statistical learning mechanism. Right. Of course, we talk about how the 96 paper can't even provide that evidence because the frequencies weren't controlled. But even in the follow-up study that controlled frequencies and still showed the same finding, even there, I think one could make the reasonable argument that babies aren't actually engaging any kind of statistical learning mechanism, that rather what they're showing evidence of is chunking. So those words, for example, so they're trisyllable words, right? The words could be in some sense perceived of as a chunk, like a coherent chunk that they would have extracted perhaps based on some statistical learning mechanism, but the result of that mechanism would be the representation of a chunk, right? And so the part words would be an example of an unfamiliar chunk, right? They would have never seen, or that chunk would be just less, it wouldn't, based on them tracking the transitional probabilities, the part word would be a less viable chunk than the whole word, than the actual words. And so the difference that they show, that is the longer listening or looking to the part words, could just be a function of them having recognized that the part word is just not a viable chunk. And so it's possible that they're using either a statistical learning mechanism or a chunking mechanism, right? This, neither study can answer that question. And this is actually an issue that Scott Johnson has brought up in his own work on this kind of topic, right? And so the question is, well, how might you go about teasing apart these accounts, right? Well, to a first approximation, what that would require is having at least three testaments. So you would have what you typically have. You have your word and you have your part word. Well, those two differ in their transitional probabilities, but they also may differ in their chunkedness, so to speak. But then you might have a third event, right, that maintains the same transitional probability as the word, that wouldn't be a chunk. That wouldn't be, so like an illusory chunk, for example. So like syllable combinations that existed, but they never occurred together, so therefore they would never form a sort of a coherent chunk. But yet the transitional probabilities would be more or less equated. And so the idea is that here, if babies look equally long at the word and the illusory word, right, that both maintain the same transition probabilities, well, then that would indicate that they are probably using a statistical learning mechanism. But without that third event, third test event, you cannot conclude on the basis of either of these two studies that they're using a statistical learning mechanism. They could be using a completely different learning mechanism. And so, again, I was mentioning that, you know, Scott Johnson and his student at the time, Lauren Sloan, they did some really cool work in the visual domain. So it wasn't auditory work, but it was in the visual domain where they explored this particular question. So you can do more or less the same kind of thing that Safran et al. Did, which is you present a stream of either speech or shapes that are defined by some kind of transitional probabilities. And then at test, you can show them, a triplet, something they would have seen, that would be like a word. Then you would show them a part triplet, which would be like, you know, shapes that span boundaries, word boundaries, but they're not words, of course. And then you would have an illusory chunk, which would be like an illusory word, which would be sort of would have the same shapes they would have seen, but not maybe contiguously. So they wouldn't have seen those shapes next to each other, right? But you can define the language such that the transitional probabilities between each of the shapes in the three-shape chunk are equivalent to the transitional probabilities between the shapes in the, the actual, three-part chunk. And so what they show in that study is that whether or not they use a statistical learning mechanism actually depends on the comparison. So if you show them a triplet, so a viable triplet, something you would have seen, so let's say cross, heart, diamond, or something. If you show them a viable triplet and a part triplet that spanned boundary and then an illusory triplet, they actually prefer the triplet over these other two, over the illusory and part. That would be not what you would predict if they're using a statistical learning mechanism, because the illusory triplet and the viable triplet have the same internal transitional probability structure. And so if they were using that mechanism, they should treat those the same, but they don't. They only prefer that the viable triplet. Now, if, for example, you do a different comparison, which I won't get into, but I would encourage, I'm going to link it in the show notes. If you do a different comparison where you're not looking at triplets, but you're looking at pairs, babies seem to show evidence of statistical learning. And so what they argue is that they're not arguing against the use of this mechanism, but it just depends on the comparison, right? And so my sort of criticism of both of these studies is, again, that we cannot know at all on the basis of these two studies whether or not they're using a statistical learning mechanism. We just can't know, because we're missing a critical test event that would help us tease apart either of these two possibilities. But again, there and like I mentioned, there's some follow-up work that does do this, and it seems to be the case that they use these, but it depends. They use both mechanisms, but it depends, and that they're probably two different mechanisms.
And I mean, reality of the world is like there's probably always multiple, right?
Yeah, but I think this study has been sold as a study that really gets at transitional probabilities, but there's this other issue. Right. And the reason it's been sold that way is because of the nature of the study. You're using artificial language. You're only manipulating transitional probability. And so, and at test, you're only manipulating that. And so if, you know, you would think that any differential treatment of the test events would only be based on them being sensitive to the transitional probabilities, but it turns out that there's this confound, another issue that neither study addresses. Another sort of related issue is that, you know, neither of these studies tell us whether or not this kind of mechanism would support generalization to stimuli that babies haven't heard. This is sometimes called rule learning in the infant literature. Gary Marcus has done some work, some really cool work, where if you familiarize babies to, words that have a certain structure, so like da-da go. So the first two syllables are the same and the last one differs. So there you can extract a rule. So first two have to be the same, last one is different. And then at test you show them completely new words, right, that either are consistent with that structure, with that rule, or inconsistent. Babies, you know, look longer at the one that violates that rule, even though they would have never heard those two test
They're both words. Novel.
They're completely novel. And it's not clear to what extent an SL mechanism, a statistical learning mechanism, that's almost tethered to the input, could even possibly give rise to these kind of generalizations beyond that which babies were either habituated to or familiarized to, right? Gary Marcus has done some, this cool work suggesting that, babies, maybe what they may be doing in these studies is forming rules.
Right. I mean,
abstract rules.
It sounds, again, like, I mean, that is like what fluid intelligence is, right? Like fluid intelligence is abstracting patterns from things that we see in the world and being able to solve problems that we haven't necessarily ever encountered before, simply on the basis of identifying patterns or relations between items. And so, I mean, at its broadest level, I feel like that is oftentimes what these types of mechanistic accounts are talking about, whether it's like, observing, relations between or associations, associational learning between different items, or the statistical probability of events co-occurring or whatever it might be. I mean, it's abstracting something from what we conceive of as this fluid intelligence. And again, being very different from having concrete knowledge about like what any of those words mean or anything more specific about them that we would think of as things like crystallized intelligence, I think.
Do you think of fluid intelligence as a kind of mechanism then?
I mean, I think when we talk about, like, if we're not even talking about just children specifically or babies or anything in our general life. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not like an intelligence researcher, but like,
but you're an intelligent researcher.
I hope so. We will see. I would hope that even though we can define the boundaries of what we say is fluid versus crystallized intelligence, it seems pretty clear that like having fluid intelligence would lead us to be able to acquire more crystallized intelligence, right? Because if you don't have the fluid abilities to be able to, for example, do things quickly or focus attention, then it's going to make it difficult for you to acquire language or learn to read or like extract meaning from written passages. And so I think that our fluid abilities can certainly scaffold our, ability to obtain crystallized intelligence. And so in that way, yeah, I do think it's a mechanism. It's a mechanism for growth and change and learning about the world. And if you were to think of it from a deficit approach, again, if you had deficits in fluid intelligence and that wasn't functioning well for you, then your ability to do or develop in some of these other ways would be much more challenging.
Right. Yeah. And in some ways, that view was actually not incompatible with a lot of what that's kind of your point, right, with what we've been discussing today. And in fact, I just went on and on about, whether or not this reflects chunking versus statistical learning. I've heard, or at least I've read or both, from, the, work of those who subscribe to the SL perspective, that chunking wouldn't happen were it not for
statistical learning. Yeah.
In order for these chunks to come to be, you have to track the transitional probability.
What other key would you have?
Exactly. And then extract those words or those syllables that have high transitional probabilities and treat those as words. And then that serves the input to some chunking mechanism. And so, you know, they argue that, you know, to some extent, they're not incompatible views, right? You use statistical learning, and the output of that mechanism serves as the input to this other mechanism, which we call chunking, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back a lot to what you always say, Dion, which I'm surprised hasn't come up already, is like, you're like, there has to be some type of innate something to get learning off of the ground, right? Like,
oh, right. So learning itself is the innate.
Right. Like, we're not like ever arguing, like, nothing. Like, this, if we have statistical learning. Yeah, no. If we have, like, this is a, like, this paper, as much as we're saying, like, this is an empiricist paper, like, it also is an innate. It's like a nativist paper saying that, like, this would be a mechanism that is innate that helps get learning off the ground, like, that we would have this capability to even track statistical probabilities. So I still think it's, like, it always gets me back to, like, it's not that we're saying things are not innate. It's what we're claiming to be innate. It's, like...
Right, exactly. And you're right. So learning itself is innate. And to some extent, you can interpret this study or these studies as providing evidence that perhaps we have this innate mechanism or this innate ability to track transitional probabilities. But to the extent that these studies are in fact making these claims, well, then they're all guilty of the same crime. They're testing 8-month-olds.
Right, yeah.
Older infants, right?
Of course. But I think that's why they also use this different language to say, is it an experience-independent or experience-dependent mechanism? Because here is what they're trying to show is, like, it's almost like they don't really care about whether or not this is innate. That's not the point. The point is that they're demonstrating that...
Can they do it?
Yeah, it's like they're demonstrating, can infants do this thing if we give them this environmental input in this very small span of time? Do we see that they can then differentiate something so that they at least have some capability based on experience to learn very quickly? And to me, that is one of the most important takeaways of studies like this, because as we argue again and again about, like, oh, well, 6-month-olds did this, and then, you know, 3-month-olds did this in a particular study, and then, you know, here we are saying, like, well, that means that they've had 6 months or 3 months of learning and experience, and the rejoinder to that is often, well, they couldn't have learned in that short amount of time this type of knowledge or preference, but if we can get infants to learn something in 2 minutes, they most certainly can learn something in 6 months. So, right? Like, I mean, I think that is a really big takeaway for me, is to just, like, recognize how much infants can learn in a short amount of time, and to keep that in the back of your mind when people are making claims about what must be innate because a 6-month-old did it.
Right. And you're exactly right. And to even sort of piggyback on this idea, you know, I think part of, you know, the reason why some folks believe that some of this knowledge must be innate is based on a faulty assumption about the nature of the world. That is, that the world is some blooming, buzzing confusion. But there's lots of regularity. Now, to that, some may argue, and in fact, some have argued, so Frank Kyle, you know, a developmental psychologist at Yale, I believe, and Jonathan Kaminsky's advisor when he was in grad school, I believe, you know, he's argued that, you know, something like associative learning couldn't possibly solve the learning problem, couldn't possibly support knowledge and concept acquisition, because the world consists of so many associations that it's hard to know which ones are relevant for concept formation. Now, you know, my response to that, and the response that has been given to that, is, well, you're not acknowledging that babies are born with certain biases that direct them to attend to certain aspects of the visual array. Right. And it's and so whatever associations that are intrinsic to those aspects of the visual array would be the ones that they learn over others. So while it may be true that there is, in fact, lots of different associations that infants could learn, they don't learn these. And this suggests that they have some biases. And we know that babies have biases. One of those biases they have is a bias for top heavy stimuli. And we know that this bias is present in the womb. Right. Another bias they have is they have a bias for moving things that move. Right. And so if a baby is, you know, first exposed to the world, they're going to attend to those things that move, and they're going to learn whatever correlations are involved in those events over other kinds of correlations. And it could be on the basis of this they come to have this knowledge, and that one needn't sort of presuppose the existence of innate mechanisms or modules or core systems or whatever. right, to explain learning. And I think that's what it really comes down to. It's sort of like, what are we willing to attribute to the infant? And specifically the issue is about how rich is the content that we're assuming infants have. And so that's part of the problem.
It's rich. It's often, rich if you assume that they are attending to everything in their environment, but they probably are not.
Or it's also rich if you're assuming they have specific expectations that, oh, animates move in this kind of way. Well, they can learn this, right, based on regularities in the world. Things with legs tend to engage in self-propelled motion, and so they learn this association, right? There's no need to assume that they're born with this, right? And so this is, you know, I can't imagine that this debate is ever going to go away.
No. No.
But I think it's worth, you know, being a sort of beating a dead horse.
I think that, and I think it leads
reminding
us...
folks.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that I continue to come back to what I, maybe we can look for and maybe cover if there's some good work out there on this. Is some work looking at, like, actual environmental experiences of infants? So I know we've talked about this before.
There is some work.
Yeah, and I think we should talk about that in a future episode, because I think that that would really help us to, like, as much as we need these controlled experimental studies, like, in a lab with, you know, these novel stimuli, all of these things, they provide us with a certain type of information. But, like, naturalistic work.
Their external validity is limited.
Right, and that's going to be a concern. So it would be very, I think, important for us to also have solid naturalistic work looking at, like, what are infants attending to? What is their actual experience? And beyond that, like, are there ways that we could track that and, even if it's in a correlational way, link that to things that they learn later on? You know, I just could see some really interesting things there that would be really good evidence for, you know, what experience really does for us in terms of our learning.
So Linda Smith, I don't know if it was Linda Smith who pioneered it, but she's like, she's done a lot of work to address precisely what you argue. So she uses head-mounted cameras. So you put them on the baby's head and you
baby
let the baby
GoPro.
Free. Exactly. And you just analyze the stats that the babies see. And even David Rackeson, my advisor, the one, you know, we had him on the podcast, he's actually done some of this work with Dick Aslan, where, you know, he's basically asked, you know, so we know that babies can perceive cause and effect relations by 6 months of age, but we don't know to what extent that knowledge or that ability is due to what they learn in the real world. And so Dave has shown actually that their performance in these tasks that look at causal learning is tied to the kind of statistics they see in the real world. And so, but you're absolutely right that, you know, the next step is to go beyond these highly controlled studies that really, I think, make the case for internal validity and do these more ecologically valid studies. And in fact, that's, again, one of the criticisms of this of these two studies, like they're using artificial language. Does this mechanism scale up to the extent that we can even say they're using this mechanism? Does it scale up to more natural language?
Yeah.
Right.
And in this one, even though I will also say that we're saying that, you know, they used a novel language, which certainly is, but like the syllables themselves that infants were hearing were also not like novel. Like that's still language. They still have heard these things before. The combinations, of course, are novel, but I mean, I guess if that was any of my criticism, what I would also say is that, like, there is no way to really probably put together completely novel language for infants. Like, that's, I don't know if that's even some, like, I don't think that that could really be plausible unless you completely used some type of, like, again, maybe like another language where sometimes there are like phonemes in other languages that are language, you know, you haven't been exposed to. So that might be one way to get around that. But in some ways.
Yeah, you're right. In the auditory domain, it's difficult. Although I think they would come back, their rejoinder would be, well, they hear the same syllables in both test events. Like those syllables they heard in the test events would have been what they heard during familiarization. So that would predict no differential looking.
Yeah, no. Right? I don't think it like takes away from the findings themselves. I'm just saying, like, in calling these novel words or novel, so, like, they're not really novel. Like, we've had some experience with them. We've been exposed to them, maybe not in these particular combinations, but...
Well, this is why testing younger infants, that's where that starts to address your issue, that what you're just raising right now, right? So if you test younger infants, not only are these words nonsense, but they probably also have very little experience with syllables, right? With those, with the particular syllables.
Yeah, I was also wondering, this was just a question that I had, and I don't know if I missed this in here, but if they also tried to map on, they created these, like, nonsense words, which, like, obviously, like, pabiku is not a word, but, like, did they actually look at, like, real frequency of the likelihood of these syllables being together? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, so...
I don't remember
so
that.
So pretty baby, for example, is a common phrase.
Right, yeah.
Like, pretty baby. So it turns out that in actual English, the
like,
probability
did they compute
that
this?
The probability that T follows pre is about 80% in English. And the probability that ba follows T is like 0.3%.
Yeah. And they did this for all of the syllables that they included in the study, where they like looked at the actual probability of those going together.
Is your question, did they look at the probability of those going together in natural language? Is that the question?
Yes.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
Okay.
Is it,
you know, like, I mean, if, again, like, pabiku is not a real word, of course, the word itself.
Oh, you don't call, like, your dog or your wife a pabiku?
I don't know, but now I will. My next pet, we're going to name him pabiku. It's a cute word. Now it's familiar. But I was just, like, curious if they actually did that. Because, I mean, right, like, maybe there's some possibility that some of these syllable combinations were more common in natural language that infants were exposed to. And if we really thought, like, maybe there's a possibility that in the ones that they had as, like, non-words or part words, that somehow those were slightly more common in the English language than the other ones. But if they didn't control for that.
I don't know if this would address your concern, but, you know, I think it's worth acknowledging that they've counterbalanced. So for some babies, pabiku would have been the word, but for other babies, what would have been the part word for the first set of babies becomes the word for the second set of babies.
Okay, they did counterbalance.
And
okay.
So, yeah, so they counterbalance.
That does make sense then.
But yet they show the same finding.
Sure.
And so I would doubt that the likelihood of both sets, like at least one of the sets occurring in language would be slim.
Yeah, if they counterbalance, then it shouldn't be.
No, they absolutely.
Then it shouldn't be a problem.
Part words for some babies served as the word for other babies. Yeah, I didn't say that, but yeah. But yeah, I mean, this was a fun study. And again, as I mentioned, this was like one of the first studies I read as an introduction to this field. And it just got me freaking hooked.
Yeah.
It's about how clever you can be, you know, with these kinds of studies.
Yeah.
I have the bug
I'll give you my last other, probably not really super valid, but who knows, criticism, which was, I mean, this was in 96 and 98, so a while ago, tech was probably limited, but...
I was like 5 years old at 96, and 96 was 5 years old, I know. I probably was saying things that were not too different from...
probably on point. So they had, when they did code these in terms of their, like, you know, okay, one... And most of these studies, we're looking at, like, differences in terms of, like, looking times or listening times. Like, these are differences in, like, a second. That's, like, a pretty small difference to be comparing. And here, their outcome measures were also, like, that was determined by an actual person, like, a human. This was not, like, eye tracking. This was, like, somebody standing there and watching for... has, like, how long the baby had over 2 seconds of a head turn, then was coded as, like, they're not listening anymore. And they don't talk about, like, whether or not those raters were blind to conditions.
Right. And also, was there reliability between the raters?
Like, which, again, short papers don't have lots of information. So, like, I mean, just, again, being devil's advocate, like, if I were to criticize a study, I think that that particular, like, outcome would be one of concern for me, that, like, you know, that... we need, like, a better measure to make sure that, like, one, we're actually tracking the exact time because the differences are so small. If we had, like, even a small bias as a researcher, you know, based on our hypotheses about the study, we could be unconsciously influencing that in some way. So hopefully newer studies have addressed this maybe with, like...
Well, so I will say that you're right. If these were the only two studies, that would be a very real problem. But this novelty preference has been replicated many times. And yeah, it's true that in each of these studies, like, the difference is like 1 or 2 seconds. But the point is, the difference is in the same direction for each of these studies. So you're really getting at something.
I'm just trying to be fairly critical of how much criticize of the individual older papers for other domains. This would be an obvious criticism here, and wanting to see it replicated in other And with other types of measurement. Like, I would want to see, like, eye tracking type of, or some type of, like, computer-based tracking of looking and head turns versus a person. Or at least to say that they were blind to condition, that they had reliability or something like that with other people.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's just a testament of the times.
Yeah. And, standards are a little bit different in 1996.
A little bit, right.
Just a bit.
Well, this has been I think this is a natural sort of ending point.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it.
This has been a super fun episode to come back on. And hopefully we can record a couple of, you know, a few more of these episodes this summer.
Of course.
And it'll be a bit more regular.
Yes, we're gonna.
Than we were during the semester. But it turns out that a pandemic and teaching and other responsibilities make it a little bit difficult, a wee bit difficult.
A little challenging.
To record episodes.
Little bit, but we'll be back, and it's good to be back and chatting with you and to be recording another cool episode and learning about more research. So we hope that you all enjoyed it, and we will be back again soon.
Yeah, take it easy.